I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. What do a ship's log from a 19th century whaling voyage and an autonomous vehicle designed to explore beneath sea ice have in common? They both can supply data that will improve climate change modeling. A little later in the hour, we talk with engineers and scientists from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution about the AUV Nereid and their work collecting data from under the sea ice. But first, we discuss old weather whaling. It's a project that uses crowdsourcing and citizen scientists to identify and analyze historical weather data from the logbooks of whaling ships. Joining us on the line from the UK is Philip Rohan, climate scientist from the Met Office Hadley Center. Good morning.
Good morning.
On the line from his office in Seattle is Kevin Wood, a research scientist at the University of Washington and NOAA's Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. Good morning, Kevin.
Morning, Mindy.
And in our Woods Hole studio, Michael Lapides. He's the director of digital initiatives at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. Good morning to you.
Hi, Mindy.
Philip, old weather whaling is a sister project to old weather, a concept that you created in 2010. So what's the mission of old weather and where did this idea come from?
Well, the mission of old weather is, as the name suggests, to discover what the weather was actually like many decades or many centuries ago. And obviously, climate change is a big thing right at the moment with the meeting in Paris that's just concluded. But something that's perhaps not that widely understood about climate change is it's not enough to understand how the present climate is changing. We have to be able to put those present changes and future predictions in the long-term context to understand how that change differs from what we saw decades and centuries ago. So old weather is a project to help us find out about that.
So what were some of the What were some of the first data sources you used in the old weather project?
Well, obviously, we're interested in weather observations primarily. But the weather observations we get don't appear on their own. They appear in the logbooks from a variety of different ships. And we started old weather back in 2010, as you said, looking at a very particular set of ships. We were looking at British warships, Royal Navy ships, from the period around World War I, from 1914 to 1923.
So what specific kinds of information are volunteers looking for as they search the digitized sources on old weather?
Well, as far as we're concerned, for the weather observations, we want quantitative information about what the weather was like. And people make observations of the weather nowadays with weather instruments, typically with thermometers and barometers, as well as more sophisticated instruments. And they've been doing that for hundreds of years. And if you look in the logbooks, you'll actually see those exact numbers. So they took out their barometer and they measured the atmospheric pressure, and they might have got 29.98 inches of mercury, and they wrote that number down in their logbooks. Mariners obviously care very much about what the weather is like. Mm. And it's that data, the pressures, the temperatures, the wind speed and direction, that we're particularly interested in.
So, Philip, you were able to take those bits of historical weather data and reconstruct the state of the Earth's atmosphere from the surface to the jet stream at the time the observations were taken. It's kind of like a window back in time. So is it possible to explain to the layperson how that's done and why it's beneficial to climate modeling?
Well, if you think about what we do for the present-day weather forecast, we actually need to start from a very clear picture of exactly what's going on in the atmosphere all over the world. We need to know where it's hot, where it's cold, where it's windy, not only at the surface, all the way up, as you say, to the jet stream. And we need to start from a clear picture of exactly what's going on in the atmosphere, because that we use as the initial conditions to run our big forecast models forward to tell us what's happening in the future. So to do that, we have tools that enable us to build this atmospheric configuration. In other words, we have mathematical models which say we understand how the physics of the atmosphere works. We encapsulate those mathematical models in a set of computer code. And we can then run that computer code on a supercomputer to calculate the state of the atmosphere. But to make sure that that state is correct, we obviously also need to add observations of the atmosphere. So we observe the pressure, the temperature, the wind, fluxes from satellites, all sorts of data. And our computers can then solve our equations, our mathematical models, in a way that's constrained by the observations. So it's that combination of observations of what's going on in the atmosphere at the moment and a sophisticated mathematical model of how the atmosphere that works that enables us to build this picture of exactly what's going on everywhere in the world.
We're going to have a link at our website, capeandislands.org, that shows an animated reconstruction of weather from 1880 and 1881 based on information from ships' logs operating during that time. It's really fascinating. Kevin, when did you become involved with old weather, and what about it sparked your interest?
So Philip and I met at a meeting, a scientific meeting in Baltimore, right around the time that Old Weather was first launched, as I recall. And that's at that point, I think Philip already recognized that our citizen scientists were going to burn through all the records that he had available. And we started talking about where we can get a new collection to work with. And so I became involved in the effort to get U.S. logbooks imaged so we can put them in Old Weather and extract data in a similar way.
Now, you reached out to the New Bedford Whaling Museum to create this project, Old Weather Whaling. So what kinds of information do whaling voyage logbooks contain that make them useful in understanding our climate?
The primary data from the whaling logs is sea ice observations. As a general rule, they don't have as much instrumental weather observations as the other kinds of ships, like military ships, do. But they do have very good records of sea ice. And that also plays a part in how the what we call the reanalysis systems work, you know, the computer models that Philip was talking about that do the reconstruction, because they need to know where the sea ice edge is. And back, you know, before there were satellites, we have a very sort of poor understanding of where it was. But the data that we would need to figure out that problem is in the whaling logs.
Mm. So explain why knowing the edge of the sea ice is important to climate modeling.
It's the boundary between the way the algorithms and the models function, because the atmosphere behaves differently above sea ice compared to open ocean. Mm.
Michael, what was the initial response of the New Bedford Whaling Museum when Kevin approached you about accessing the museum's most prized possessions, original source material from whaling voyages?
Well, we were quite excited, although at first there was some skepticism as to whether or not we wanted to participate. These are, as you mentioned, our prized possessions, and some of them. And it didn't take long, though, to get people to see at the museum that this was a very valuable project.
So in order for the whaling vessel logbooks to be accessed as part of Old Weather, they have to be digitized. Had the museum begun to digitize its collection at this point?
On a very small scale, we had done it. And what this allowed us to do was scale up and really start to do quite a bit more. So at this point, we've been focusing on the Arctic logbooks in the collection. In our own collection, there are about 300.
So describe the process of digitizing fragile artifacts such as ship logbooks.
Well, you need to be very careful. The books are often brittle, and so you handle them very carefully and under controlled conditions. Kevin and partners at the National Archive shared with us a workflow that's been very helpful. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a long sheet of how-to-dos.
I guess you can sort of understand the skepticism in the beginning when we're talking about, I mean, some of these logbooks are extremely fragile, and you don't want to handle them that much. So was that really the biggest concern? It wasn't really sharing the information, but it was what would happen to these artifacts. Was that really the concern?
Well, by making digital facsimiles of them, we really can reduce the actual touching of the logbook, which, of course, is important for us from a preservation standpoint. So digital preservation as well as access to the primary source and the data contained within. They're both very valuable.
Yeah. So once the source material is digitized, can you walk us through what volunteers are actually doing as they comb through the logbooks on Old Weather Whaling?
Sure. Well, what they're actually doing are extracting these points of data that Philip and Kevin referred to, sea ice, wind, direction, longitude, latitude. So the platform, Old Weather Whaling, brings the user to an actual page in a logbook, which is highlighted. They call that marking. And then from the marking, from the marked piece of data, users are asked to extract the information and to transcribe it onto the page. And then behind the scene, I'm not sure exactly how that filters down through Philip's algorithms and such, but that's what our users are doing.
Yeah, I'm going to get to Philip about that in a second. So is it sort of like a search engine in a way that highlights this what you're looking for them to transcribe? And because I'm thinking there's a lot of information in some of these logbooks. So how do you get to what you're looking for?
You press the button that says transcribe and it brings it right up.
So it's like a search engine.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Well, yeah, It's very simple.
Yeah. So there must be challenges associated with deciphering and interpreting some of the information in the logbooks. Can you describe some of the resources available to assist volunteers? I'm imagining not everybody had the best handwriting.
Well, that is a challenge. And we've noticed that we've had fifth graders and seventh graders do it. We've had researchers do it. And there's a wide variety of ability to do this. But we've picked logbooks, at least initially, that are easier to read. Mm-hmm. So we do have on our website, whalingmuseum.org, on our main logbook and journal page, we have a well-written and accessible document called An Introduction to Whaling Logbook. So it gives some insight into how one might approach the logbook if you've never read one.
And what these abbreviations and things
all
mean.
Yes, exactly.
So, Philip, how do you know that the information volunteers are entering into the system is valid?
Well, we ask we get every page in a logbook read by three separate volunteers. So essentially it's done redundantly. Mm-hmm. And that means we can cross-check the information that anybody types in with the other two people that looked at that page. And in situations where all three agree, we've got good confidence that they got the answer right. And when they don't agree, we actually know that we're still uncertain about that point. Mm. So there's a sort of automatic error detection built into the process.
Yeah, that's a great idea, having three different people do it. Kevin, you've been working with the National Archives to gain access to digitized logs from government ships. How does the data from those government vessels differ from the data found in whaling voyage logs?
The principal difference is that on military ships or Coast Guard, Coast Survey ships, essentially government ships, the officers are keeping hourly records of instrumental weather. So there is all the things that we need are written down every hour without fail. And it's quite striking because I've seen some logbooks of ships that were just laid up in a shipyard. And as long as there was a crew on there, they maintained the hourly weather no matter what. Mm. And the same goes for when some of the military ships go into battle. They don't stop doing the weather.
So, Philip, how do you determine what sources might have pertinent data? Is there a time period of voyages more or less important than the regions they sailed in?
Well, very often we rely on the advice of experts like Michael as to what they have in their archive that might be useful to us. So we have colleagues with expertise in handling archives and in understanding old documents, and we look. So we have contacts at the National Archives in Washington and the National Archives in the UK, and we spent quite a lot of time actually looking through their collection to find out what's in typical logbooks and what we need to get extracted. Hmm.
Michael, the New Bedford Whaling Museum has decided to expand its educational mission through old weather whaling. So explain how you're engaging both students and adults.
Well, in terms of adults, we have partnered with Second Half organization in Fall River, and we've done some lectures with them, for instance. And we can encourage a lot of these are retired people, and they're looking for projects to do at home. It's a great opportunity for them. In terms of schools, we've got a local charter school, for instance, who sends a few students every week to work on this project. These are seventh graders, and they're having a great time doing it. They really enjoy reading these primary sources. So there's a wide range of skill levels that are able to use the platform.
And still plenty of room for more to get involved in other schools. And
exactly, yeah. So we are in the process with the latest cycle of funding, writing curriculum for teacher-ready material, so to make this material more available to the widest possible range of people.
Old weather whaling takes data from whaling voyage logbooks, as we're talking, for scientific research. But do you see historical or humanities-based projects that could take advantage of the old weather model?
Well, certainly. And the beauty of the platform is that there's sightings of wildlife. There's other material that can be pulled out. Of course, this isn't what the climate scientists particularly want, but it is in the data set and can be pulled out over time.
Mm, something you'd like to explore at some point, I
Absolutely,
would imagine.
Yeah.
We're talking about old weather whaling. Joining us on the line from the UK is Philip Brohan, climate scientist from the Met Office Hadley Center. We have on the line also from Seattle, Kevin Wood, research scientist at the University of Washington and NOAA's Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. And in studio with us is Michael Lapides. He's the Director of Digital Initiatives at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about the Old Weather Whaling Project with Philip Brohan, climate scientist from the Met Office Hadley and Center, joining us from the UK on the phone. And in Seattle on the phone, Kevin Wood, research scientist at the University of Washington and NOAA's Joint Institute for the Study of the Atmosphere and Ocean. In our Woods Hole studio, Michael Lapides, director of digital initiatives at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. Philip, you started Old Weather, as we mentioned, back in 2010. So you've put nearly 5 years of data through your reanalysis system. Have you seen changes in the modeling of climate change as a result of the data collected?
So what we have seen are some definite improvements in the quality of our reanalysis. So as we said, we build this reanalysis, this comprehensive picture of the state of the atmosphere. We build that picture going all the way back into the 19th century. Okay, and we can measure how good we think it is. We have metrics of the accuracy. And we've seen, you know, substantial and significant improvements in the accuracy in areas where we've been able to add new observations from our historical weather ships.
Is the historical data being collected by Old Weather useful in assisting the computer models we use for near-time weather forecasting?
Not directly, because the near-time weather forecasters are interested in the state of the atmosphere now and not in the state of the atmosphere 100 years ago. But it does help us in interpreting those forecasts. So in other words, particularly we want to estimate the power and accuracy of the models with which we use to make forecasts of short-term weather. And in order to do that, we make essential forecasts of what happened in the past. We make hindcasts. And the information we're collecting is critical for those hindcasts. So essentially we're producing validation data, tests, for the currently used forecast models.
Yeah. So, Kevin, historic voyages were often long, and ship log books must have a lot of information to cull through. So explain how the crowdsourcing aspect of Old Weather makes accessing such vast quantities of data possible.
Well, it's mainly because multiple people can work on the same thing, and that way you can work through it more quickly. And then once that's done, it becomes accessible, you know, to computer analysis, and then we can start to map and do things to the collection altogether, which are very informative and otherwise impossible without that first step.
Michael, participating in Old Weather whaling can appeal on many different levels, and you're talking about a lot of different age groups and not just scientific ones. What are some of the reasons you think people will enjoy participating in the project?
Well, it is touching history. I mean, when you can read a document somebody wrote 150 years ago, and you can imagine what it was to be on the deck of a whaler, I think it's an exciting thing. And from a history standpoint, certainly. And there are narratives that support this. And typically, the really exciting thing about this for us is that typically our audience that would come to the research library is a limited number of hundreds of people who might write critical pieces about the whaling industry. But now all of a sudden, the consciousness of what this industry was so many decades and centuries ago becomes much more available.
Or to the masses rather than just
exactly.
Academics. Yeah. So, Kevin, do you have any statistics on how many people have participated in Old Weather so far?
I think it's around 22,000.
Wow. Wow. So what do you think is one of the most compelling reasons for people to engage in this project?
Well, I think the sense of being able to sort of rediscover history on your own is a very powerful idea. And, you know, some of the books that we've been using, particularly the ones at the archives, have been sitting on the shelf basically since the end of the voyage. And so when we're, you know, presenting them through Old Weather, they may not have been seen since then, and we have no idea what's in them. There was a case a couple of years ago when one of the logbooks had pressed flowers in it, and it's like, wow, wonder where those came from. And so there's all kinds of interesting discoveries. And I might add along this line that we have a very active volunteer moderator community, and they also do some of their own research. They follow their own interests, and there are two examples that I like to talk about. One is volcanoes. So the ships, particularly the ones traveling up in Alaska, would see when the Aleutian volcanoes would erupt or something would happen along those lines. And that information gets pulled out and sent directly to the Alaska Volcano Observatory and it gets sent to the Smithsonian Global Volcanology Program. And they use that data to update the chronologies for various volcanoes that we know about, and also when a new volcano appears. And that's something that, that people do on their own. That's not really part of our science program, and it's just a good thing to do, and they recognize that, and they carry that out on their own.
Kind of cool. So these online communities that have just sort of formed as a result of this.
That's right.
Yeah.
There's another group that keeps track of aurora, and they pass that information over to another Zooniverse project called Solar Stormwatch. And, you know, that's also, you know, something that they take on their own.
Likely want to add something?
Well, yeah, Kevin mentioned the pressed flowers. I was digitizing a logbook the other day, and you often find in the end of them where there are empty pages that the logbooks have been reused. There was a whole bunch of poetry. I don't know who it was by, but when we talk about who else might be interested, we like hanging around with these scientists, but there's other purposes.
Well, it's interesting when you just, I can imagine, you know, you open this logbook and you find these pressed flowers, and it really makes you think, doesn't it? Who picked these flowers? Why? And why did they put them in the book? And it's almost like this little time machine transporting you back to another place in time.
Yes, you're in people's lives here.
Yeah. So, Michael, what do you find as one of the most compelling for volunteers to engage in a weather whaling? Is it, as you mentioned before, the touching history? Is it also partly, are there discoveries they might make that, even though it's in the digitized logbook?
Yeah, I think the volunteers, there are different types, and some will just go right after the data, but you can get lazy on a page and or read a particular section that maybe the weather doesn't need, and for your own reasons. Again, the descriptions on it may be very interesting. They may be talking about polar bears, or they may be talking about poetry or some native encounter. So there's no requirement that you have to, you know, do a certain amount of data every half hour you sit down. You can linger on a page and get lost, or pages and get lost in the history.
Yeah, we've been talking about CS, but Phil, go ahead.
We have found on some of the previous old weather projects that people's reasons for participating are very diverse. So we actually teamed up with some social scientists and ran a survey with obviously the assistance of our volunteers to find out why people participated. And unsurprisingly, people participate for all sorts of different reasons. Some of them like the sense of contributing to science and helping with climate science. Some of them like the history. Some of them like the community in the project. As Kevin says, there's a very active volunteer community, a lot of, you know, social support and shared interest. And some of them obviously like the ability to do their own research. There's a lot of non-scientific information which we've rescued from the historical logbooks, particularly the Royal Navy logbooks.
Mm. So, Philip, are there regions of the globe that you don't yet have adequate historical weather data? I mean, we're talking about sea ice here, but do you have plans to find data sources for other regions as you enter into the old weather system?
There certainly are, unfortunately. And obviously, the further back in time you go, the bigger the regions with no, the bigger the regions with no information. So one of the reasons we like the whaling logbooks is that whalers, or at least the ones that we're dealing with New Bedford, went to the Arctic. And the Arctic obviously has very few human inhabitants. There are very few people there with barometers. It's a very sparsely observed area, particularly valuable for us.
Mm.
Basically, if you imagine an area where few people live and few people visit, we're likely to need more weather observations for that area.
Mm. As you're looking through some of these, and anybody can jump in on this, I'm wondering, like you mentioned the pressed flowers, what's some of the most interesting information that you found, whether it relates to the project or not?
There are some fascinating little vignettes of history in the logbooks. So, for example, this year, 2015, is the centenary of one of Shackleton's famous Antarctic expeditions. And he's mentioned in one of our Royal Navy logbooks, 1815. All it says is, Sir Ernest Shackleton came on board, and the ship at the time was in the Falkland Islands. And if you know your history, we know why he came on board. He was trying to commandeer the ship to rescue his men, but he doesn't say that. So the very terse entrance in the logs can give you, you know, a fascinating perspective on particular historical events.
Yeah. And Michael, I'm wondering, just thinking, you know, you've got the logbooks that the captains kept, but there were also books that were kept by the crew, and sometimes that, not necessarily with weather data, but sometimes that doesn't always, that doesn't jive.
Well, actually, the logbooks that we're mostly digitizing here are kept by the first mate.
First mate, okay.
And in fact, at the Whaling Museum, In our research library, we have 2,600 logbooks and journals. The journals can be more personal.
Right.
And
that's what I was thinking, journals, I guess.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So those are also being digitized in this process.
Yeah. And now, is your plan to have everything, all the journals and logbooks at some point digitized? I mean, I know it's probably a big project, but is that the goal?
Well, it is a big project. This project will bring us to about 10% of our collection. And at this point, we're taking a case-by-case basis. I think from a preservation standpoint, it'd be absolutely wonderful to have every logbook digitized, but we do it as necessary and, of course, as funding allows, right, because it's not inexpensive.
Right. I was also thinking, though, you know, perhaps, I don't know if you get some volunteers. I don't know if that's I guess you can get volunteers using the digitized stuff, but to actually have them digitize it, you need staff who knows what they're doing.
Absolutely. We are training some apprentices to help with this, but also we have a partnership with the Digital Commonwealth out of the Boston Public Library. Mm-hmm. The Digital Commonwealth is a part of the Digital Public Library of America. So there's a large network of museums, libraries, and archives that are undergoing this process of digitizing mm-hmm. collections. And the idea is to bring these together.
Yeah. I'm also wondering, aside from the weather info, somebody mentioned polar bears. And, you know, you look at some of the endangered and even extinct wildlife or fauna even. I would imagine these logbooks and journals hold quite a lot of information that they can tell us about the evolution of a particular species or...
Well, you know, certainly whales, because that's what our guys were looking for. So there's always note when there's a spouting or when there's a hunt. So, of course, that's of interest to us. But as you say, other... polar bears, other species as well.
Yeah.
I've noticed that whenever a 19th century person sees a polar bear, they usually kill it.
Oh, that's not what we want to hear. So, are there other museums and libraries participating with the old weather whaling besides New Bedford?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So, Providence Public Library got into this. I think Kevin, perhaps maybe at the same time as us, I'm not sure. But at this point, the New Bedford Whaling Museum is also acting as a center of digitization for a group of other libraries and museums. We're working with the New Bedford Free Public Library, with Mystic Seaport, with Nantucket Historical Society, with Martha's Vineyard Historical Society. So we're trying to gather as many logbooks, not just our own, that will help this project.
Mm-hmm. Philip, anything you want to add to that? Are there other folks working on this with you?
Well, I would like to mention that Old Weather is, of course, part of a larger initiative. Mm-hmm. So from a science perspective, you know, historical climatology, understanding and modeling the weather is a big international project. Okay. So we collaborate with people in many different countries to try and recover logbooks. And I aspire in the long term to have not only, you know, U.S. whaling logbooks on Old Weather, but we're hoping to add maybe some Canadian logbooks. So we're always interested in looking out for more material that might have weather and valuable historical information in that we could eventually add to the system. Mm.
So this is a long-term project we're talking about.
Yeah, very much so, yes. Yeah.
And when do you anticipate having enough data to really impact what we're doing as far as climate modeling?
Well, climate modeling is a complex process. So we go from the basic data gathering to building our picture of the atmosphere, to building our understanding of physics, to testing it, to making projections about the future. It's hard to sit there and say, okay, you know, this is the point at which we've made a very clear-cut and obvious contribution to climate modeling. But the work that we're doing is nonetheless vital. You can't do climate modeling without our historical observations. We've already made an easily demonstrable quantitative improvement in the quality of our understanding of historical climate.
Mm. Is there...
there's one benchmark that we can define pretty well, and that will be when we finish digital imaging every Arctic logbook in the U.S., that exists. And I think we are not so far from that.
Hmm. Is there, and I know none of you do this type of science, but I'm wondering this, you know, just actually going into the ice and some of this deeper ice and seeing what's in there, does that help us? I mean, does that tell us anything about the weather, you know, that when this iceberg was formed, what it might have been?
I think with the ice observations, what is going to prove the most useful in the near term is basically finding out where the ice edge is and how thick the ice may have been around that area, because there is another project that we're working with that's running a sea ice model to try and understand how the Arctic ice itself has changed. And again, the primary, some of the primary data we need is validation data to make sure that what the model is showing about the long-term state of the Arctic ice is showing something that's realistic.
Yeah, and we're going to have a link to old weather and old weather whaling at our website, capeandislands.org. Philip Brohan, Kevin Wood, and Michael Lapides, thank you so much for joining us. Really fascinating project you're involved in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And coming up after a break, we discuss how the extent of present-day sea ice can help us better model the impacts of climate change. You're listening to The Point. Joining us to discuss how the extent of present-day sea ice can help us better model the impacts of climate change and the new robotic technology that allows researchers to obtain more precise data about the ice is Ted Mascom. He's an applied ocean physics and engineering scientist at HUI, Wutzel Oceanographic Institution. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Mike Jacoba, a research engineer also with HUI's Deep Submergence Lab. Welcome to you, Mike.
Thank you.
All right, Ted, before we talk about the new technologies to study the ice, can you explain why sea ice is important to climate change modeling?
Well, sea ice is sort of, I guess, it's been described as the canary in the coal mine of climate change. It's probably the one component of the Earth's climate system, at least in the Arctic, that has been seeing some of the most dramatic changes. And we've been able to see that because we can monitor it pretty well from space. Over the last 35 years, we've had satellites consistently telling us how much there is. And we've seen that in the extent of summer ice, that the amount of ice we see at the end of summer is declined by about 50% over the past 35 years.
Wow. So what kinds of information about the ice do you try to quantify?
Well, as I said, the thing we look at the most really is how much area it's covering. That's an important thing because the ice acts like a blanket over the ocean. It insulates the ocean, keeps a lot of the heat from getting out. But in summer, what we see is if you remove that ice, then you're changing the color of the ocean, really. It's going from bright white, so it reflects all the sun, to almost black, absorbing almost all of the sun's energy. And so if you start removing that ice, you get this feedback, and it really inputs a lot of heat into the ocean, which is a dramatic change in the Arctic and accelerates the melt of the ice. Some of the other things we're interested in are things like the thickness of the ice. So we can measure how much area of the ocean is covered by the ice. It's a much more difficult question to get at is how thick it is, because that's more difficult to see from space.
Yeah.
So that's one thing that people have been going up to the Arctic for years, trying to get a better assessment of that and try to compare what we see in the field to what we see from satellites so we can be able to monitor that over the long term.
So what are some of the challenges to studying the ice, and has that limited our knowledge of the sea ice? I mean, you mentioned this thickness. What are the other challenges?
Well, it's...
It's cold.
The challenge is it's cold up there. Yeah. It's a long way away. It's hard to get to. And if you want to get into the ice, there are really two ways to do it. And one is go up in an icebreaker. And that's where, you know, things have advanced from 100 years ago, where we have these observations from vessels at the ice edge. Now we can penetrate deep into the center of the ice and up all the way to the North Pole. But that's a really expensive undertaking. The other way is... you know, we can go out on the ice, fly out in airplanes, and land on the ice. That's, you know, a little trickier. There's a lot of logistics you have to put in place to make that a safe undertaking. So it's a difficult environment to operate in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you have to deal with cold, winds, and just difficulty accessing it.
Yeah. Really. Now, Mike, you're the lead engineer on the NEREAD Under Ice project. What's the project tasked to do?
The project is to provide essentially the same kind of capability to interact with the environment as we provide now with the Deep Submergence Lab in deep water, but not covered with ice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's essentially an ROV system, remotely operated vehicle, that allows operators and scientists to project themselves into the environment to get high-definition video back, and ultimately to also to emplace instrumentation to take samples and bring those back to the vessel.
Nereid, Greek goddess, named after a Greek.
The story is that the antecedent technology was developed for the Nereus project, which was specifically to access the very deepest portions of the ocean. And the key piece of technology is the Nereid's NUIs, as we call it, fiber optic tether, which is a communications-only tether. It's only about 3 times as thick as a human hair.
And wow.
What that enables is the vehicle to be decoupled from the motion of its host vessel. So in ice, that's critical because otherwise your maneuverability is very limited,
yeah,
whether working on the seafloor or underneath the
ice. And the ice can move around and stuff. It's a very scary environment to be working in, right?
Right, yeah. So, I mean, the traditional sort of justification for robotics is that they're appropriate where things are dull, dirty, or dangerous. And danger certainly applies in this case, both to human operators and humans, as well as the robots themselves under the ice. Dull makes a lot of sense if your goal is to map large areas. That's not really suitable. That's a great task for robotics, and maybe dirty doesn't so much apply in this case.
But. Yeah. So from an engineering perspective, what are some of the challenges of operating an AUV, autonomous underwater vehicle, under the ice?
Sure. I think I can probably speak to robotics in general. So to be clear, NUI is really more of an ROV or a hybrid system. Whereas AUVs, which have been used under the ice for a long time, in fact, the very first AUVs were back in the mid-70s were used under ice. But I think in general, one of the bigger challenges is operating efficiently under the ice, by which I mean that the vast majority of time devoted to that vehicle is spent with the vehicle collecting useful data. It is extremely expensive to operate off an icebreaker or on an ice camp, and you want to make as much hay out of that time as you possibly can. So if there are hours and hours involved in deploying or recovering the vehicle, that's an extremely inefficient use of time. So I think that's probably the biggest challenge, and it's imposed in a sense by just the cost of working in the environment. And of course, those same considerations apply working in blue water without ice cover, except that it's just we've been doing that for so long. We know how to do it efficiently. So adapting the methods that we use in blue water to working under ice is a challenge.
So what is Nereid equipped to do?
It's equipped ultimately to interact with the environment, to project human presence into the environment. So presently, it's equipped with a variety of sensors and a reconfigurable payload, like a traditional deep water ROV. So you can put more or less whatever you want on it. And that includes mapping sonars, instruments designed to measure biological activity in the water column, and as of March of next year, it will also be equipped with a large hydraulic manipulator, which is really the culmination of the project in the sense that it will allow scientists to finally actually collect samples and interact with, including in placing instrumentation under the ice.
So you say equipped with whatever you want to do. So are you like taking these vehicles and like talking with the project manager or the scientists who are going to do this and say, okay, here's what we want to collect, and you can actually change equipment is on there to meet the needs of whatever the project is?
Absolutely. And that comes directly from our experience with more traditional ROVs. They are pickup trucks fairly accurately.
Pickup trucks of the sea.
That's right. So the expectation is that the sensing payload, the instruments you want to carry, will change from cruise to cruise, if not from dive to dive. And that's even more the case once you add manipulation capability. So these typically come with a reconfigurable tool basket. So the tools you'll take with you are different, the samples that you'll bring back are different, and the means of storing those samples during the transit are typically different as well, depending on what's being done.
So, Ted, what are some of the biological samples you find in the ice, and is that data also useful in the climate modeling?
It's useful in terms of understanding what, is going on with the ecosystems in the Arctic, and that's really a very open question. I'm not a biologist myself. I work on the physics of ice, monitoring how thick it gets and how it grows and melts. But when it does that, if you can imagine that it's such a forbidding environment that it's a very difficult place to survive. And ironically, one of the places where you find a lot of biology is in the ice itself or right at the ice bottom where you have a lot of algae, because it's a relatively safe place for them to be. You start removing that ice cover, you change that ecosystem. Mm-hmm. Now you get a lot of open water where you can have blooms of algae. Maybe that's going to have other organisms which feed on that respond. And so a really open question that I think a lot of people are looking at now in the Arctic is, what's going to happen as that ice disappears in summer? How is the ecosystems going to change? What's that going to do to what we call higher trophic levels, like fish and whales and so forth?
Yeah. So will more detailed information about the CAs also help us in weather forecasting?
Yeah, sure. We have like I said, we have a pretty good idea of how much sea ice there is. And when we're doing weather forecasting, we're only talking about a week or two ahead. And so things generally don't change that much. Mm-hmm. It helps if we understand the processes that are going on in terms of the heat that's coming out of the ocean or the atmosphere to get a better idea of what's going on with the weather. And one of the things we do actually to help us with weather forecasting the Arctic, because you can imagine there's not a lot of weather stations up there, is we put buoys out on the ice or in the open water, and those report back the weather conditions. And those are really critical for helping weather forecasting. Mm-hmm. But the real thing, I think, where understanding what is going on the sea ice is going to be in checking to see how well these climate models are doing.
Yeah.
An interesting thing happened, you know, over the past few years. As I said, the sea ice has disappeared at a very dramatic rate. And actually, it turned out to be much faster than climate models were predicting at the time. And so people have been looking at, you know, what actually are the processes we're getting wrong and try to fix those models. And we're getting closer at understanding that. And so a real important question over the next several decades, because we think sea ice is probably going to disappear in the summer for the most part, maybe by 2050, but we don't know exactly. Is it going to be 2030, 2050, 2070? That's the kind of thing we're trying to get at.
Well, it's interesting too, when, and I know you guys don't do the biological samples, but I would think, you know, you're studying the processes, but those biological samples would tell us a lot about, you know, the history and, you know, what's gone on there. That ice can tell us a story, right? Along, not just in the climate modeling, right?
Right, it does. You know, if as a ice physicist, what you do is when you take a sample, you take an ice core and you look at what's the structure of the ice. It's not just a continuous piece of ice.
It's not all water, yeah.
we looking at the structure of it and the salinity of it and things like this, we can learn a little bit about how it formed and what its history was almost through the entire winter. And that's really important for understanding how that is going to control what's going on in the ecosystem associated with that ice. To a certain extent, we can tell looking at, you know, the critters that are associated with the ice, what the history of that ice is a little bit, but it's more the other way in that, you know, you can imagine anybody's, you know, how you live here in Massachusetts versus how you live in Alaska is determined by what your environment is. And that's the same for the algae in the ice, is the environment that is housing them. That ice itself in the ocean below is really driving, you know, when algal blooms can happen, when krill can feed on the underside on those algae, and when the fish come.
So it's kind of scary to think about how quickly that is changing and what that environment might become, right?
Exactly. And that's where a lot of people are really looking at. And there's a lot of interest in what's going to happen in the Arctic. Because, as I said, it's you know, the bleeding edge of climate change, really. It's the environment we're seeing the biggest change in. And it's...
That means,
What does that mean? Yeah. So what does that mean for the ocean? Because it used to be covered with ice and now it's water. What does that mean for coastal communities that used to be protected by the ice a little bit? They didn't have, you know, the waves breaking on the shore as much as they do now. So what's going to happen to those communities? What's going to happen to subsistence hunting when they rely on whales and seals and walrus and so forth?
Yeah. So, Mike, you've had some sea trials with Nereid. How did the it perform, and what's the time frame to have her ready to embark on a research cruise?
Sure. So we had sea trials back in 2014 off the German icebreaker Polarstern. It went really very well. I was expecting between 4 and 6 dives, and we managed to attempt 5. One got demoted to a dunk, but we still got 4 good dives. And our goal was to demonstrate do some concept demonstrations for scientific data, and we've actually managed to get a scientific publication out of the vehicle in addition to a bunch of engineering publications. So that's actually exceeding what I was expecting, which was great. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, the manipulator integration is supposed to finish in about March, as well as a number of other upgrades to the vehicle that will improve the logistics of handling it over the side. So the vehicle development project will be complete in summer of 2016, and our hopefully next cruise will be in September and October of next year.
Mm, okay. So do you ever worry about, like, I mean, we're talking about the cost of these vehicles. Do you worry about losing them? Does that ever happen?
Yeah, I mean, it would be irresponsible not to worry about that. So, yeah. I mean, obviously we spent a lot of design effort making them robust to the sort of likely failures based on past experience. But no, loss is absolutely a possibility. It's a harsh environment. And again, there's a significant cost associated with spending a lot of time. So mm-hmm. if you lose the vehicle and you are going to have to spend days finding it, that's probably not a good trade-off. Mm-hmm. But from my perspective, you know, 5 or 10 years down the line, if this vehicle is stuck under ice somewhere, but it's done a lot of work up to that point, that's a much better outcome than having it sit in a warehouse.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it's really fascinating just the technology and how far we've come in being able to do some of these studies. You know, I mean, we're able to get under, I said we would never have been able to get under, you know, how many years back, right?
Yeah, well, I think what's really changed is the sensors that the platforms carry. So Nereid is a little bit of an interesting vehicle in providing manipulation capability under ice, but mapping under ice has been done in various forms for a while. But the quality of that data is continuously improving with sensors getting better. The techniques are getting better. TED has worked a lot with AUV systems under the mm-hmm. ice, and those maps have revealed some really exciting features that TED is better.
What's been the most exciting feature, TED?
The most exciting feature, just to get back to your last question, is getting the vehicle back on board. Yeah. So that's, you know, you asked about, you know, losing a vehicle, and that's always the scary thing. And with the Nereid under ice, you've got a tether, so you hope you can direct it back. With AUVs, it's running completely free. You put it under the ice and you more or less hope it comes back. You can kind of send it messages to get it back, but you're going through a very small open water area. You can imagine you're there right. In the winter, you might only have a small bit of area of open water behind the ship, and you send it off and something goes wrong. It's not like, you know, if you're down in the Gulf of Mexico, you can just have it pop up and then go find it. If it pops up under ice,
it's under ice.
It's a real challenge getting it back. And we've had to deal with that a couple of times. But that is, so when you get it back on board and you download the data and you actually are looking at what the ice looks like underneath its underside, it's really exciting because that's, you know, you think about ice, it's like an iceberg. You know, only a tiny bit of it's on top and most of the ice is underneath.
Yeah.
And until recently, when we now have the capability to put vehicles under the ice and look at it, it's been really hard to get a really good picture of what that looks like underneath. And now, you know, with the technology we have, we can image the ice in ways that we could only have imagined, you know, a decade or two decades ago.
Yeah. And we'll have a link to images of Nereid working under the ice at our website, capeandislands.org. Ted Maxim and Mike Jacoba, thanks for coming in. Very interesting stuff that you're working on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.